Welcome to the Fantasy Baseball Beat.
Welcome to the Fantasy Baseball Beat, part of the Pitcher List Podcast Network. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Chris Torres. I'll be your host today. On today's episode, we are going to be talking ballparks. For our Beat Writer Roundup segment, we'll be discussing several Beat Writer articles that detail ballpark changes that you need to know about as you prepare for your upcoming fantasy drafts. We'll be giving our analysis on how some of these changes will be affecting the way that we value several fantasy-relevant players. Next, we'll be identifying five hitters who changed teams this offseason and discuss how the shift in home park may affect their fantasy production. We'll also be discussing some recent bullpen news, debating whether Andrés Muñoz is in the elite closer tier, and also giving you the most undervalued closing option currently on the board. But before we get into all of that, I want to thank our listeners for making our last episode the most downloaded and listened to episode since our podcast started. Now, some people may say there's a few reasons as to why this happened. Number one, we're getting into the prime fantasy baseball draft prep season, right? We're in February now, so people are starting to really pay attention. Or maybe it was because the last episode was about the Mets, and there's a lot of Met fans out there. I have a different opinion. I can't help but think that the success of the last episode may have had something to do with the fact that our normal co-host, Mike Carter, he wasn't here. He wasn't feeling well that day, and he couldn't join us. But because of the success that we had last time without him being part of the show, we've made a unilateral decision to let Mike go from the Fantasy Baseball Beat. I have an official statement that I would like to read on air. So we at the Fantasy Baseball Beat are starting a new chapter. Effective February 6, 2025, we have terminated Mike Carter from the program. We appreciate Mike's contributions to the program over the years. However, it was apparent that his unwavering support for the worst team in the history of baseball, his love for Lourdes Garcia, and his old age were driving listeners away from the show. We wish him well as he endures another 40-win White Sox season. There will be no further comment on this matter. Please respect our privacy at this time. So there you have it, folks. It is a new chapter in the history of the Beat. So moving forward, it will be me and my co-host, Dave Funnel. Dave, how's it going, man?
It's good. Melancholy. I mean, I will miss Mike a bit, but business is business, right? And it's one
it's
thing.
It's all about
the
ratings, baby.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, we'll miss him, but in the end, oh, Mike.
Wait.
What? Hey guys, how's it going? Hey. I'm sorry for being a little late. What's going on?
Who let him in here?
Wasn't me.
Security? Hey. All right, guys, we're going to have to cut the audio. All right, get him out of here. Get him out. I'm sorry. We're just going to have to take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back.
What in the heck is going on here?
All right.
I feel like I walked into a party that I'm not invited to.
Mike, what are you doing here? We terminated you.
Oh, I guess nobody sent the memo to me then. Why would you guys terminate me? What am I out?
Well, are you all right, listen. Listen, what happened last time is that we had the most listened to and downloaded episode in the history of our show without you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Number one.
So maybe it was coincidence, but maybe it was something to you not being here. But anyway, I mean, you're here now, so we're going to have to move forward. And let's just forget about everything that I said before.
I didn't catch anything that you said before. I guess I'll have to listen later.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
Don't worry. Okay. So we're good for all tonight. Right. I'm okay to hang tonight. It's all good.
Yeah, we'll figure something out. All right. But just anyway, Mike, it's good to see you, buddy. So happy to have you back. We miss you. We love you, man. We're just playing with you.
Yeah.
We are going to get into some ballpark.
That was a good one, guys. That was a good one.
Yeah. We're going to get into some recent beat writer articles that detail some changes that have been made to some ballparks, such as Camden Yards, some park shifts, right, that we have with the Rays and the A's going to minor league parks. So let's jump right into it. I'm going to start with I'm going to go to you first, Dave. And I know you had given us this article on the changes to from Oakland Coliseum to Sutter Health Park, the AAA affiliate for the A's, where they'll be playing this season. So if you could start us off by giving us your main takeaways from this article. It was written by Martin Gallegos. And the title of it was, "Will A's Park Be Hitter's Haven? Not as much as you think."
Yeah, the biggest thing here was, I think that what Martin was trying to do was trying to temper the expectations that people have. Because a lot of people are thinking that going up to Sacramento, that it's going to be a hitter's haven there. But he was trying to just show that it's not necessarily what's going to happen. Now, one of the big things was, it's just a reminder that the two stadiums, last year's Coliseum and this year's Southern Health Park, the dimensions are actually quite similar. Specifically in left field, they're both 330 feet. And when you look at center and right, there's only a 3 and a 5 foot disparity. So it's not much of a difference there. Another thing that they talked about was, there are warmer temperatures on average in Sacramento, but there is less humidity. So, and humidity plays a huge part in the way that a ball travels, because the more humid it is and the hotter it is, the ball just travels farther and faster. So out in Sacramento, the weather, I know last year it was very hot there, but it doesn't actually always equate to, you know, more hitting. And another thing that they talked about was that the league is already planning for this. They're trying to balance this by 60 of their first 81 home games. They're actually going to be at night. And that includes that there's only 6 home Sunday day games between June and August. That's usually a day game for most teams. But they're really trying to change anything that's going to make this park feel more like a hitter's haven. And it turns out that in 2023 in the PCL, from where this place was, it was actually one of the best for suppressing runs. Now, it's unsure if that was just because of the talent that was there or if it was because of the dimensions and everything that we just mentioned. But the main part of this was that everyone thinks it's going to be a big hitter's haven, but it probably will be maybe a small bump forward, but not as much as people think.
All right. So given that, how does this change, Dave, for you, the way you value players like, you know, a buzzy guy in drafts this season is Lawrence Butler, right? And then Brent Rooker, we've seen his ADP jump from, you know, now he's up to almost a top 50 pick. Does it change at all the way you value either of those players, or are you kind of tempering your expectations?
I think in general, my expectations of Butler have been tempered even before this, only because I know a lot of people are talking about his second half, but he was very, very streaky in that second half where he had huge ups, but huge downs as well. But of the two going into this ballpark, I do like Rooker more, and I do like him more after having read this as well. I know he's had some success there as a minor leaguer, and he's proven to me that he's been able to hit for power with 69 home runs over the last two seasons. And primarily what he did was he just hit better against sliders, and I think that can continue here. And he did it well while being injured for a lot of the season. So knowing that and knowing that this ballpark is a slight bump, I do believe in Rucker because he is going to get his outfield eligibility. And yeah, I'll take Rucker over Butler.
Okay. Yeah, I was I misspoke there on the ADP. So Butler is going last 11 DCs according to the NFBC, going at around pick 69. Nice. Brent Rucker, not top 50. He's going 72nd overall. So I'll tell you, man, and I was very like beginning of draft season, I was kind of lukewarm on Rucker, especially just because seeing that big of a jump in ADP from year to year, usually I'm a little cautious with those type of players. But man, I think I'm kind of all in on this Oakland offense. You know, I like Butler. I really like Shea Langeliers where he's going around pick 130. I feel like he's basically Cal Raleigh going, you know, 50 picks later. I really, even Jake Wilson, different profile, right? But he's going around pick 340. He's going to play every day. We know the average is going to be, you know, above average to elite. So I really like this A's offense. And I understand that maybe we need to temper our expectations. Like, this isn't going to be Coors Field, right? But when we're talking about going from the Oakland Coliseum, where, you know, we're used to just like streaming the worst pitchers, right? Like, we feel okay streaming like a below average pitcher in Oakland Coliseum because of how pitcher friendly it was. You had all of that foul territory. And the other thing was really the temperature, not so much the dimensions, but the temperature in Oakland, especially these night games, like the ball does not carry, right? It's usually colder. Same thing with San Francisco, which is why their park is so pitcher friendly. It was usually colder, and being right on the bay, there's this, I am not a certified, you know, I'm not a meteorologist, but for what I understand, this marine layer coming off of the bay adds to humidity, which makes it harder for the ball to travel. So I think the difference between where they were to where they're going, which is a more dry climate, like you were saying, I think that's going to show up. And at least, you know, if it gives them another 5 home runs, like, think about how that changes the value at the end of the season for some of these players. So I'm all about it. Yeah. I know Martin in this article will kind of poo-pooed it a little bit, but I'm in on this narrative. All right, so we're going to move on from the A's. Let's go over to, now this isn't a ballpark shift, but we're going to look at a ballpark that is changing dimensions, and we're going to take a look at Camden Yards, which is bringing in their left field wall, and Jake Rill of MLB.com wrote about this article called "A Happier Medium After 3 Years, O's Modifying Left Field Wall Again." So, Mike, take us through, what was it? What do you think is the most important thing that fantasy managers should know about this?
So, Jake Rill is going to be on with us in 2 weeks, and awesome. We're looking forward to having him on to talk about Orioles. But what the article really talked about was that, you know, the corrections that they made to the stadium at Camden Yards, starting in the 2022 season, where they raised the fences and pushed them back a little bit, they've decided to correct back the other way because it was too much of a disparity towards pitching and not enough towards offense. And so what they found over the course of the last few years was that several of their big time hitters had lost home runs because of the way the defenses were put together there. Not only are they further out, they're also really high in certain places. So what they've done is, in certain areas in the left field parameters there, they've moved them in as far as 20 feet, and they've also lowered the wall from 13 feet in certain places to more like 8 feet or 6'11", so that, you know, those balls that have been hitting the wall there are now going to be going out. So over the course of the last 3 seasons, get this, I did a little research on this. Ramon Urias, not known for being a home run hitter, lost 5 home runs because of the wall. Jordan Westberg last year lost 4. Jorge Mateo, Anthony Santander, and Adley Rutschman each lost 7 home runs over the last 3 seasons because of the confines of Camden Yards. And so they're redoing that to put an emphasis on better offense in Camden Yards. What it does for me, I think, is that it really allows me to take a look at those right-handed power hitters that maybe have been discounted over the last couple of years. And when we're talking about guys like that, we're talking about, in my mind, we're talking about Tyler O'Neill. We're talking about Ryan Mountcastle. We're talking about Jordan Westberg, all right-handed hitters. It really would appear that with this change, that right-handed power is going to play well again in Baltimore. And I would think that those guys, especially Mountcastle and Westberg, O'Neill to a lesser extent until we figure out exactly what his playing time is going to look like. But Mountcastle and Westberg are guys that we should probably inflate a little bit in our ratings just because of the fact that they're changing this. The term that Mike Elias used was, we need a happier medium. And so that was why they've decided to redo the fences there. Interesting to me, I thought, they only really gave it 22, 23, and 24 before making a decision that they were really deflating their offense by having the walls be the way that they were.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Ryan Mountcastle. ADP currently, last 11 DCs, is 238. Sounds like you're in at that price, but you tell me, Mike, what are your thoughts on him?
Absolutely. I think that this is a player that absolutely can hit 30 home runs in that lineup, given playing time and given the new park dimensions there. I have always felt that Ryan Mountcastle is underrated. I think it's because people don't know exactly, when they look at him, they don't know exactly what he is and what they think that he can be. And I think we get lost a lot of time with that in fantasy. You know, we dream about what we think a guy could be as opposed to what that guy is. And Mountcastle is a very useful player, especially at this ADP.
Would you wait on first base and make him your starter?
That's a really good question. I think that my tendency, I've been thinking a little bit about draft strategy here, obviously, as we're in the middle of February and it's time to start hitting those things. I do think I'm waiting on first base unless I luck into a Freddie Freeman or Vlad Guerrero or somebody of that nature. And I don't see myself targeting a first baseman that high. I really think I want to get a shortstop and address outfield. Same thing with third base. I don't know, like, you know, if I don't get a guy like Machado early on, I think I'm probably going to wait until I get down a little bit lower. I really, really want good shortstops this year. I want a starting shortstop that's a stud, and I want my other middle infield guy to be a shortstop as well. And I could see me doing something like two of my first five picks on shortstops, but we'll see if that really comes together or not.
Hmm. Yeah, well, the shortstop, it is interesting the way ADP is settled. I feel like you definitely need one by pick, like, I'm just pulling up ADP here, by like pick 180. And I'm not even, like, Zidane Raffaella is kind of the last one. He's the last. And I'm not even super confident in him. I'd say it's more like Dansby Swanson at pick 168. Yes. You kind of need you need to lock in one, if not two, because even after that, if you're looking at a backup shortstop, you're getting into really murky territory very quickly. I've looked at Jacob Wilson in my most recent draft. I actually took him because I feel like he's kind of like he's viable as a second shortstop in a draft and hold. He's going at pick 341, but like you're talking about guys around there like Jose Caballero. We don't know what his playing time is going to look like. Trevor Story, so many, you know, questions around him. Tyler Fitzgerald, Willie Castro, like guys that just you don't feel 100% confident in. So I agree with you on shortstop. That's a different, you know, we'll save that discussion for another time. But getting back to first base. I think it makes sense. You could definitely, I think it is viable to wait and go for either Mountcastle, or there are like several guys in that tier. You've got like Nathaniel Lowe, Andrew Vaughn, Yandy Diaz, who are all kind of in that tier. Yandy Diaz a little earlier, but I think those are kind of, if you're going to wait, I think you could still get passable production. And if this change really does, you know, improve Mountcastle's power output, then you could be really getting a steal there. I mean, we know he's got the raw power, but, you know, we have yet to see it. People blame it on the wall. We'll see. I know, like, it is a thing. I saw a quote from Trey Mancini talking about this from several years ago. Like, it's a thing. It gets in your head. You know, these players, like, you know, when they're at home. I remember when the Mets moved to Citi Field, and it was a thing with David Wright. He talked about it openly. Like these guys, when they're in a pitcher's park, you know, some of these players, it gets in their head. They start messing with their mechanics to compensate for that. And you see, you know, them not putting up the numbers that they're capable of. So definitely looking forward to see what these Orioles right-handed hitters do. I mean, I remember when Camden Yards, it was like, man, you wanted everybody on the Orioles, right? Like before they moved the fences back, it was like Camden Yards was like one of the best places to hit. So hopefully they can find that happy medium and, you know, stop robbing these players from multiple home runs a year. All right, let's go to another team in the American League East and let's talk about the Rays. Now they're going to a different park. As we know, Tropicana Field got damaged by Hurricane Milton, and now they are going to be playing at Steinbrenner Field, the Yankees minor league and spring training park. So that's going to be super interesting going from a dome to, you know, a park that's outdoors that has the same dimensions as Yankee Stadium, playing in Florida in the middle of the summer. So we could expect some pretty big changes there. There was an article we wanted to talk about that was actually from Baseball Prospectus. I really, really enjoyed this one. Yeah. That was by Jacob Edelman of BP. And the title of it was New Stadium, New Sluggers, Three Rays Ready to Rake. So, Dave, tell us about this article. He pointed out one player that I'm very interested in this year, and that's Jonathan Aranda. So tell us why we should be, based on the article, particularly interested in him.
Yeah, and I just want to reiterate, this was a really, really good article. So I really think a lot of people should go read it. The biggest thing that I took from this before getting to Aranda was that we should expect a lot of offense in Tampa. He did a study and he looked at like the rising fastball rates of all pitchers. He looked at the Wobbekon of, you know, Tropicana and Steinbrenner, the spray charts comparing two things. And the biggest thing that we could get from this was that we're going to see a lot of offense, and it's justified by, you know, where everything was in Tropicana and at Steinbrenner Field for last year's spring training. I do know that the one that he really, really liked was Jonathan Aranda. And I think there's a chance here for someone to really, really, this is almost league winning value here for where he's going. He's going to get regular at bats at either the DH or first base platoon. Last year he hit 260 with a 268 XBA versus fastballs, and he was still pretty decent against breaking and off-speed pitches. But he's a left-handed batter at Steinbrenner Field, and these dimensions are exactly the same as they are at Yankee Stadium. He pulls the ball. He had an 11.2% barrels per plate appearance. That was sixth in baseball last year. He came up in September and he hit 253 with five home runs. Give me him all day long. He's past pick 400. He's done it in the minors. He was injured last year, which stunted some of his development. I am buying him all day long with, like I said, I could see top 100 value going here.
Dave, I've never heard you as confident in a player take as I did just now. That's Jonathan Aranda is your guy, it sounds like.
He's my guy.
Besides Bo Bichette.
Yeah, that's true. He does, but he didn't have the same level. Like that that level of confidence I haven't seen in one of Dave's takes. That's Aranda is his guy. Aranda's going at pick 334, last 11 DCs. I like it. I mean, I do think the ceiling is a little bit capped because the Rays are an array, right? But all of the underlying batted ball data, I mean, last year, this is 97 batted ball events. I get it. So it's a smaller sample. His barrel rate was 16.5%. That's an elite territory, right? And I think the results didn't quite match what the contact quality indicated it should have been. He only had a 430 slug. X slug says it should have been 518. His hard hit rate, according to Fangraphs, was 47.4%. Now you're putting him in Steinbrenner Field with a short porch in right field.
Yep.
In that Florida heat where the ball is going to travel. The pitchers aren't going to have the same advantage. He talked in the article, Jacob Edelman did, about how pitchers in Tropicana Field were shown to have a higher IVB, induced vertical break, both home and away. So this was a thing. There was an effect pitching in that stadium that led to better results for pitchers. So now not having that, I think it's wheels up for a guy like Aranda. And he also mentioned some guy. He also mentioned Richie Palacios in the article. I don't know if Palacios gets enough playing time for him to be like some breakout, but I think he's a useful piece and a draft and hold. And then a guy who was way, way, way off people's radars, isn't even being drafted in some of these 50-round drafts that I kind of have some interest in, is Curtis Meade. I don't know what the rate, like, he had the prospect pedigree. I was all about him, you know, like 2 years ago when he came up. Results never really like came to fruition for what his potential was. But I mean, in that park, I think he's got an approach too, where he's a right-handed batter who goes to the opposite field. If the Rays give him one more opportunity, I think we could see finally what we were looking for from Curtis Meade. So a guy in a super deep league, AL only, to keep an eye on. I think there could still be something there. All right. Last article we're going to look at is in regards to the Mariners. So this is not, there was no changes with T-Mobile Park. But we wanted to discuss this article by Mike Petriello, who we know he works for MLB.com. He's like the StatCast guy. You see him on the ESPN2 StatCast broadcast. But this was an interesting article about T-Mobile. Title of it is MLB's Most Extreme Ballpark Isn't in Colorado. So, Mike, tell us about this article and what were your takeaways from it?
Boy, you're right, Chris. It was a really good one, and I did really enjoy reading it. And it talked really about how at T-Mobile, offense is really suppressed to the point of 11% suppression compared to other ballparks in MLB. And one of the things that was interesting was that they pointed out that there are a variety of different reasons and theories why T-Mobile Park is playing this way. The offense, like I said, is suppressed 11%. All of the hitters have higher K rates at home than they do on the road. They have a weird batting eye that's not square behind them, but actually on a bit of an angle. And you guys might remember that Teoscar Hernandez had talked about that a couple years ago. He had his worst season as a pro while he was in Seattle, and he blamed that batting eye as one of the main reasons why he was not able to pick up the ball coming out of the pitcher's hands. They also have a weird situation there, too, during certain points of the season where the sun really wreaks havoc on the guys being able to see. The interesting thing, too, and I did not know this. I don't know if you guys knew this, but the roof itself is not essentially a roof as we think of a roof. It's not airtight. It's more like an umbrella on wheels, and they just wheel it over. So even when the roof is quote-unquote closed, it's not a roof per se, so there's still air that's getting in there. The average game time temperature in Seattle is also about 62 degrees, and we know that it can be very rainy out there and wet and not necessarily extremely humid like we think of a lot of other places get during the course of the summer. But the thing that was really interesting to me about it was that I think that, you know, hitters have a tendency, like you were saying, Chris, to want to be comfortable and to understand the things that are going on around them. And it really felt like in this article that there were a number of different factors that might be contributing to this, but that nobody was really certain exactly what that key takeaway from it was. When I dug a little deeper into looking at Seattle's lineup, they have a lot of guys in their lineup already that are predisposed to striking out. When I looked at the numbers of the guys that are in their prospective nine-man lineup for this coming season, seven of the nine guys that are going to get regular at-bats had strikeout rates that were higher than league average. So including guys like Julio Rodriguez and Luke Rayleigh, Cal Raleigh, Randy Arozarena. The only guys that I remember falling below that were J.P. Crawford and Victor Robles, who are not what we would think of as power hitters to begin with anyway, right? So it was a really interesting piece in that Mike kind of pointed out there are all these issues that are going on with it, but that nobody is 100% certain exactly what it is that's causing that to make hitters be so uncomfortable there. But the research really does show that they strike out far more often at home than they do when they're on the road. In terms of, you know, strategies for takeaway, you know, I don't know how you guys feel about the Mariners, but I'm not super crazy about drafting many of them. I mean, I could see a situation where I end up with Julio Rodriguez. I think he's going to have a really good season again after maybe being a little disappointing last year. I left Cal Raleigh. I think he's going to walk into 30 home runs. But other than that, when I look at them, I don't see a team of hitters that I'm really super interested in. Like, I could see drafting some of those guys as fill-ins and bench players for my team. But other than Raleigh and Julio Rodriguez, I'm not like super crazy about like Victor Robles or like, you know, Mitch Haniger or anybody like that, you know? So I to me, the takeaway was, yeah, you know, Seattle's offense. Oh, okay. You know, like, I'm not sure that I would really be targeting too many of those guys to begin with anyway.
That offense stinks. That offense is brutal. I mean, besides Julio Rodriguez, I mean, and this is why I have a tough time clicking on Julio in the first round. You know, I mean, he's coming off the down year. Okay, you could say that was an aberration. But man, like the offense around him, the counting stats, like, I just don't think you're going to be there. It's brutal, man. Like, you've got JP Crawford, like, you know, Jorge Polanco coming off an injury, Victor Robles, like, there's not much there. Even a guy like Randy Rosarena, I know people are kind of looking at him as like a bounce back, a possible cheap 2020 option. Like, I'm just not about it. Like, a guy who I already think might be declining in terms of his skills and athleticism, and then you put him in a bad park in a bad lineup. Mm-hmm. Like, I just see, you know, I guess the bottom's not going to completely fall out because they have nobody else to take playing time. But I think it could get pretty ugly from an average perspective for a guy like that. So, yeah, I just, you know, and the other thing with T-Mobile, like, I really feel like we no longer have, as we talked about before, we don't have Oakland Coliseum to stream crappy pitchers in. I think T-Mobile is like an automatic, like, unless we're talking about Martin Perez, right? Or like that.
Oh, here we go. Here we go.
You know, I had to bring up a White Sox. Like,
What about Sean Burke?
I'll pitch Sean Burke with 100% confidence in Seattle against that lineup and in that park. Like, mm-hmm. I think, you know, the title of this article was about, you know, Seattle being the most extreme ballpark more than Coors Field, obviously right. In opposite direction. But I think we need to start thinking about it really in that way. Like, think about, when we talk about streaming a pitcher in Coors Field, we're like, we're only going to stream, like, you know, aces in that environment, right? Because we understand how bad the environment is for pitchers. I think it should be the exact opposite when we're talking about Seattle. And on the hitter side, you know how excited we get when it's like anybody signs with the Rockies, like, oh my God, they're going to get 81 games in Coors. Well, when somebody signs with the Mariners, we should be like, oh crap, like, somebody's going to be playing 81 games in T-Mobile Park. So,
and maybe even streaming weekly too. If you know, you see a team heading out to Coors, you stack up on all their hitters. Maybe if you see a team going to, you know, Seattle, you want to pick up one of their late starters.
Yeah. Yeah. And like all the Mariners pitchers, I think those guys are just good, right? Like, yeah. Logan Gilbert's really good. George Kirby's really good. But then you add in the park that they're in, and I'm like, I want at least like one of these guys, even like a discounted Luis Castillo, right? Like, people kind of like whatever with him this year. But he's still pitching in Seattle. Like, that's so huge. So yeah, I think that's, you know, the park stuff. I think sometimes we could get a little carried away with it, but we got to pay attention, right? And hopefully talking through some of these changes and some of these extreme park effects is helpful as you get ready for your drafts. But we are going to transition to talking about a few players who are changing teams and how their home parks are going to affect them. But before we do that, we are going to take a quick commercial break. All right, we are back. Mike is still with us. So we're happy to still have him here. Of course, this is our buddy. Like, you're going to be with us till the end, Mike. You better be. So we won't get rid of you. but let's talk about a few hitters who are switching ballparks. And I thought it'd be interesting to look at how their home park may impact their projection and, and their overall output. So let's start with Jake Berger, who I thought was one of the biggest winners of the offseason in terms of where he came from to the park that he's going to. So we know that Berger got traded from the Marlins, which is a notoriously, which is a pitcher's park, right? With a 92, using the past 2 years, it has a 92 home run park factor. He's now going to Globe Life Field, which has a 114 park factor for home runs. So obviously a huge shift. He's going, he's bumped up in ADP since the trade, but want to get your guys' thoughts on Berger. Are you chasing the ADP up? Like, do you buy into this park shift, and do you think Berger kind of has a breakout because of it?
I'm buying in. I like where he's going. Like we said, with the park shift there, and the fact that he did it while playing in Miami is probably the biggest turn on for me. It's that he was able to go into Miami. Like, the park factor there is just, for right-handed power, is near the bottom of the league. So if he was able to do it there, I think he'll be able to transition to a much better ballpark with a much better lineup. And if we're looking at him as a first baseman right now, I have him here around the 11th off the board, just based off some ADP. But he's in an area where if you miss out on the top guys, I think you can buy in and get at least 30 home runs this season. And if you draft him as your third baseman, I mean, you could still, like, I'm in on Berger. I love
that the dual eligibility does help. First base.
It definitely helps, because it helps you earlier in the draft. If you find yourself, you get your first baseman, you can take him as your third. If you get your third baseman, take him as your first. And if you don't get either, he's there for you if you need him. So I'm in on Berger.
Berger is there for us.
Yeah.
I was just looking up here. You talked about the difference in right-handed hitter park factor, and if you go to Stack or Baseball Savant, you could break that down between right-handed and left-handed hitters. So just confirming what you were saying, Dave, Globe Life Field for right-handed hitters jumps up to a 120 compared to Lone Depot Park. What a crappy name. Some of these parks, really, like, they should reject some of these sponsors because the name is just so bad. Like, no one wants to call it, even like we were saying, T-Mobile Park. Like, these names suck. But anyway, Lone Depot Park, right-handed hitter park factor, 85. So going from 85 to 120, a huge jump. He's probably not going to hit. He definitely won't hit as high in the Rangers lineup as he did with the Marlins. So maybe a few less at-bats, but obviously the lineup is much better. So who knows? That may all be a wash. Mike, I had asked you guys to come up with a bold prediction based on some of the players that we were talking about. I'm going to just ask you for yours right now because it had to do with Jake Berger.
Yeah, I'm a White Sox guy, right? I saw him play here. He's a first-round draft pick for the White Sox. And I this is a guy that's becoming a burgeoning, consistent performer. 30 home runs seems to be a given if he just falls out of bed the right way. And he's a guy that you root for. He had some pretty horrific injuries coming up. Tore both of his Achilles tendons at different times, missed almost two complete seasons of minor league baseball. So he's a guy that you're always rooting for. I think he is going to hit higher up in that lineup. A roster resource has him batting eighth in that lineup. I don't see that happening. I think he's going to hit further up than that. And I really do think that this is a guy that's going to hit. He's hit 250 3 years in a row, a la Chris Davis, right? But if you think about what he can do and how hard he hits the ball and playing in a better park with a better lineup, I think this is a guy that can hit 270 and hit upwards of 40 home runs. And I really do believe that.
All right. Wouldn't want you lying to me here. All right. I'm just pulling up his his oopsie projection. What? Another talking bad names. But I think Jordan Rosenblum, he wanted to mess with us podcasters and just make us sound dumb. by saying the oopsie projection.
Oopsie.
So for Jake Berger, we've got 34 home runs, 94 RBIs, a 252 average. Mm-hmm. It's a projection. So, you know, there's room for more. So, yeah, I mean, that's pretty juicy at that price. A nice juicy burger. So, all right, enough with that. We're going to move on to the next player, switching ballparks. I'm in on this guy. I'm totally in. I'm like, how Dave felt about Jonathan Randa, this is how I feel about this next player. And that is Michael Conforto. Now, he's going from one of these parks. We talked about the A's and playing out in the Bay and how those parks, like, it's really hard to hit home runs, San Francisco and Oakland. He's going from San Francisco to now going to Dodger Stadium. So he's going from one of the worst parks to one of the best by park factors, going from an 80 park factor to 122 at Dodger Stadium. Obviously, we don't even have, like, the shift in lineup quality, right? Going from the Giants to going to the Dodgers, where it probably hit fifth or sixth against right-handers. I'm all in on Conforto at his price. I've got him around pick 300 in multiple drafts. I understand, like with Aranda, there is that cap on his playing time. I don't think he's going to be playing against left-handers. Maybe the Dodgers give him, like, I don't know, 25, maybe 50% of left-handers. I think that would be pushing it. You know, the Dodgers are always going to do what's analytically sound, right? And analytics tell you to always have platoons. And they got guys, right? They've got Andy Pages. They've got Chris Taylor. I think he's still there. Mm-hmm. They'll probably sign Kike Hernandez. You know, so they'll have options to platoon with him against tough left-handers. But I think what Conforto will give you against right-handed hitters alone makes him worth his draft pick. And I think he's being undervalued because, you know, he kind of fell off the radar. He was came up with the Mets, was a big prospect. He had a couple really good years. Then he had that terrible shoulder injury where he dislocated his shoulder on a swing. It took him a while to come back from that. But I think second half last year, you saw him fully healthy and you saw what he could do even in not the best of circumstances. So listen, the Dodgers are smart. The Dodgers aren't going to sign anybody that there's, you know, like I trust their decisions, and they went out and were aggressive in getting Conforto. I love him this year. Am I wrong on anything I said there? Do you guys disagree?
No, I mean, they paid what, $17 million for him?
Yeah. So, right. They're paying him too.
Yeah. So I like him where he's going. My only concern is just his health, just because it's been hamstring injury after hamstring injury over the years. But he's produced when he's on the field. And it feels like the Dodgers will just go with the hotter hand. I mean, they especially in the outfield, there's always that one spot where there's that unknown. I think they did it with Jason Hayward, and they've had other names out there. I think there's a chance here. If he remains healthy, he's going to produce. So, yeah, why not take a shot on getting a piece of the best lineup in baseball?
Yep. Paul Goldschmidt, another guy who's switching teams. Mike, want you to get your thoughts on this one. Goldschmidt goes from the Cardinals to, you know, which is not a great hitter's park, park factor of 90 for home runs over the past 2 years. He's going to Yankee Stadium. So tell me your thoughts. I know, you know, we've got a guy here who's possibly starting to decline. I think entering his age 37 season. Are you in on Goldschmidt given the change in context, or are you kind of shying away thinking this might be another Jose Abreu?
Yeah, there's, you know, the three of us have talked about that in our group text quite a bit. And I see a lot of similarities between Abreu and Goldschmidt, you know, lots of hard hit grounders to shortstop. Goldschmidt seems like he's made some adjustment and it might still be a serviceable player. The problem that I have is that I think people are going to inflate the fact that he's playing for the Yankees, potentially batting cleanup. I don't think that the salad days of over 30 home runs and having double-digit stolen bases are going to be there for him. I mean, he's 37 years old. He's clearly in a level of decline. the Yankees actually have a couple of hitters that are kind of like that. I would say Bellinger's kind of in that same class of, like, and his batted ball skills don't look like they're that great to me anymore. That being said, they're both going to be serviceable players for the Yankees. It depends on where you want to get them. Goldschmidt's a guy that I could see hitting somewhere between 20 and 25 home runs with a depressed average. You know, somebody hitting probably 235, 240, maybe stealing, you know, 5 to 10 bags. So there is value in our game for that. If you're expecting Goldschmidt's going to hit 330 again, I think that, you know, you're out to lunch on that one. I don't know if anybody really is doing that, but there's an automatic charge that comes with a guy going to the Yankees, right? So, like, that to me, that's always the thing that I'm navigating is somebody's probably going to be willing to pay that price earlier than what I am. Like, I'd way rather take Jake Berger than Goldschmidt. You know what I mean? Like, right, straight up right now, I'd rather do that.
Yeah. You know, I'm surprised that Goldschmidt hasn't risen more. He hasn't gotten more of a Yankees tax since he signed, because he, I think right now I'm pulling up last 11 drafts. He's at pick 174. I don't have the what he was going where he was going earlier, but I mean he's probably risen about 20 picks or so. I think he was going around pick 200 in that range prior to that. So not a huge jump. I think there is, you know, especially those of us like myself that drafted Jose Abreu last year. You know, it's kind of we feel we don't want to take that chance again on aging first baseman. But I do think the park shift does really matter for him. And if you look at Goldschmidt's underlying batted ball quality, like it was all pretty good last year. Like it wasn't too far off from what he's done in years prior. He did get a little bit unlucky. There was a little bit of slippage in skills, but I think there still could be one good year. I'm fine with him at price. Not a guy that I'm like, you know, gonna, he's not like a huge target, but someone that I think if he's there in the right build makes sense to take a shot on. Let's go to another player who's leaving Yankee Stadium and now going to Detroit, and that's Gleyber Torres. This is a guy I'm totally out on. Maybe it's just because I'm burned by what he did to me last year. He was like my most rostered player, thought going into a contract year, you know, like a good balanced profile, gives you some speed, some power, you know, good Yankees lineup. I was all in last year, and he was such a disappointment. Now that he's leaving Yankee Stadium, going to Comerica, which is one of the worst hitters parks, I'm just not about it. What say you, Dave?
Yeah, I'm not in on him at all either, but it really wouldn't surprise me if he actually bounced back, because I don't know mentally if he was all there last year. Just watching some of the highlights and the errors that he made on the field, it felt like he just didn't want to be there. And it felt like he was, I don't know if he was just jealous that he wasn't the star or something about it, but the body language and the lack of not sportsmanship, but teamwork, it just felt like he didn't want to be there. He wanted out. Maybe he couldn't deal with the pressure. I don't know. Given what we've seen out of him, I think he is still someone that's overrated, but it wouldn't surprise me to see him, you know, just say, you know, I'm all in this year. He's betting on himself, putting in the effort, putting in the extra work to get that long-term contract. But I'm not going to take that chance, even at his draft price.
Yeah, I just don't see, like, that is just kind of Gleyber, right? Like, he just has that. That he almost reminds me a little bit of Robinson Cano in the way they would play. He's not as, like, I don't think gifted as Cano, but like just kind of like lackadaisical at times. And it seems like he's just kind of just not really giving 100%. I don't know what it is with Gleyber. There is something there because there were just too many mental mistakes, and that's been a staple of his game. So I don't know. Maybe there's another veteran presence on the Tigers that kind of like takes him under his wing. And like, I don't know. I'm just making
sense. No, just be done.
Just be done. Thank you. All right. Enough. Anyway, on to the next player.
Hot take.
Yeah. No more Torres. You may be saying that about me as well, Mike.
maybe I got an idea for a cold open for the next show.
Okay, nice. There you go. I'll let you do that one. You do the outline for next week. Last player we're going to discuss is Kyle Tucker. So this is a guy who's a first rounder. You know, I think he provides a really nice balance profile. Now, moving though from Minute Maid, I think it's still called. I don't know. It might be another stupid name that they gave it.
They did.
How about Enron Field? Let's call it Enron Field. That's I like.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
He's moving from the ballpark in Houston to Wrigley. That one is staying the same. But it's not a huge downgrade. But interestingly, Wrigley played very pitcher friendly last year, more so than in prior years. So maybe it was just a thing, the wind. You know, we know the wind is very impactful there. Maybe there were just more days the wind was blowing in. I don't know. Could also be advantageous at times when it's blowing out. I mean, you know, you look at an over-under in one of those games, it's like 11 or 12. So he could also take advantage of that. But where are you guys at on Tucker? Do you have any concerns on, you know, him going from Houston? He's played there his whole career, now going to Chicago, going to a little bit of a ballpark downgrade. Mike, tell me what you think.
Yeah, I'm a little concerned. I mean, I think the level that we've been wanting for Kyle Tucker, I mean, he's a fantastic player, don't get me wrong. But, you know, his batting average has kind of been, you know, he had a 257, then he was at 284, and like last year he was hurt with the injury that, you know, wasn't really supposed to be a serious injury, and then it ended up being a fracture and cost a lot of people that really valuable time in their fantasy seasons. Wrigley Field has a really bad, undeserved reputation, like you were just reporting, of being a home run launching pad. It's really not. And so I think that there's a possibility that he has a little bit of a depressed home run total and steals 20 bags, but that maybe it's not a terrific Kyle Tucker season like we're used to with Houston. And quite honestly, I also want to see him be healthy. You know, that's something that's a little bit concerning to me. You know, so this guy goes from the Houston lineup to now he's going to supposedly hit second in this lineup with Ian Happ in front of him and then Seiya Suzuki behind him. But I'm not super jacked up about the Cubs lineup either, to tell you the truth. So I think he's going to provide them with a lift, but I'm not 100% sure that this is going to be the breakout season of 40-40 or anything like that. I mean, he's still going to be really, really good, but I've been hedging a little bit about taking him in the first round. I'm a little wary.
Yeah, I had this dilemma in my last draft. I was picking at pick 7, and he was there, and that's about where he goes. And I was like, at first I was like, oh, I think it's definitely Tucker here. But then I just thought more about it. And because of the ballpark shift, also, you know, switching teams, switching leagues, I think I don't have anything statistically to back up the statement, but anecdotally, it feels like these players, whether it's through free agency or trades, like their first year getting acclimated to a new team and especially a new league, there's usually like you're not going to get like a ceiling season, right? Like usually you see a little bit of a downturn in their performance. So for that reason, I'm kind of out on Tucker. I probably won't have any moving forward either. You know, I just don't see like him putting together some like season that's going to bury me if I don't have him. So, yeah, no Tucker for me. But we are going to leave that segment there. We're going to be talking bullpens with Mike. But before that, we are going to take our last commercial break. All right, we are back. So, Mike, we wanted to talk to you about this last week before you left us. but I want to get your thoughts on a recent signing, someone everybody was kind of waiting for to see, you know, where he would land and how that would affect the rest of these closers. And that's Carlos Estevez. He went to the Royals, much to the chagrin of people who drafted Lucas Erceg. But tell us, what are your thoughts on this bullpen? Do you think that people who have Erceg, basically, you know, should feel like they don't like Erceg is basically a wasted pick? What are your thoughts on this bullpen?
I think everybody's got to pump the brakes here a little bit. There was a lot of gloom and doom. I mean, Erceg was really climbing up charts, and mine too, as a guy that was, you know, as a wonderful pitcher. I mean, he's got a four pitch mix. He's essentially a starting pitcher masquerading as a closer with what he brings to the table. My first take on it really was, you know, Ursing is just a much better pitcher than Estevez is. I mean, I know Estevez has had the job, and we know that that means something in context to managers, right? Like, they want a guy that's done the job. They want a guy that doesn't wilt under the pressure of it. Estevez has had a couple of pretty productive seasons closing, even though his stuff on the surface doesn't look like it's that typical great closer stuff that we look for. For those of you who've taken Ursing, do not panic. I still think that he's going to end up being the closer eventually. Whether this is a timeshare at the beginning, we don't know yet. Matt Cotraro has not announced what his plans are for this role. But I definitely could see a situation where Estevez wins the job in spring training and then has a couple of rough outings early on and they switch back to Ursing. I mean, Ursing has done nothing to be able to lose the job. The one thing that Ursing's at a little bit of a disadvantage in is that he really can pitch multiple innings. And he's a guy that could end up being a high leverage reliever in that Royals bullpen, along with guys like Hunter Harvey and John Schreiber. They've got some depth that they've added to the middle part of their bullpen. I just think that Ursing is a much better pitcher than Estevez, and I don't think that Estevez will hold that job the whole year. I just think Ursing is a lot better than he is.
Yeah, I think Estevez is really living on that label as capital C closer. I'm putting in Lucas. I'm sorry, I'm getting sidetracked because I put in Lucas Ursing into the Fangraphs search bar and it autocorrected to Lucas Erect. So that's not, I'm not looking up that type of stuff in the middle.
What position does he play?
Oh man, I'll tell you later tonight. Anyway, yeah, so Lucas Ursing, let's see. I mean, if you're just looking based on peripheral numbers, on stuff, like Ursing is, like you said, Mike, he's the much better pitcher. Even looking at Estevez last year, he had a .226 batting average in balls in play. So I agree. I think we'll see what they announce at the beginning of spring training. Maybe it's a committee, and if it starts out that way, I feel like there's a decent chance Lucas Ursing could find his way in the role just because he's the better pitcher. So we'll see. So those of you who have Ursing, maybe there's still an opportunity there, and maybe this is a buying opportunity. Like if you're in a DC now and Ursing is really slipping, I'm sure there are drafts where that's happening. Maybe a time to take a shot if he's, you know, slipping down to 250, 300. So, so that is the KC bullpen. Thanks for your analysis on that, Mike. I wanted to talk about your most recent article over at RotoBaller. You all should be checking out Mike's work over at RotoBaller and at Fantrax. Your most recent article, I found it interesting that you talked about Andrés Muñoz there. Mm-hmm. And you identified him as someone who's being drafted as an elite closer, right? He's in kind of like that. He's not tier one, but he's like that tier two going around that round five range in 15 teamers. But you kind of pumped the brakes a little bit and you were like, he might not live up to those expectations. So tell our listeners why you think that might be the case.
Quite simply, I think that this is a talented pitcher who's got an incredible arm, has great stuff. You look at the Statcast and you think, wow, this is the guy that I'm looking for. This is the guy that I want. But one of the questions that I asked in the article was, how many times did Andrés Muñoz save 30 games? And the answer to that is never. He in three seasons closing at least part-time, he has 4 saves, 13 saves, and 22 saves last year, which was his high watermark. So you're getting a guy that's got a really good K rate, a little bit fewer innings than what you might get from a more, you know, what we would call quote-unquote elite closer. So you're paying a price tag right now of a, you know, the 10th or 11th, closer off the board right now, who's never earned 30 saves and has a checkered injury history. I saw recent drafts where he was getting taken ahead of guys like Raisel Iglesias. Well, that's a mistake. Raisel Iglesias is one of the best that's ever done the job, and he's probably going to get 30 saves again, even with less sexy statistics than what Munoz does. The question that I have is, you know, how is Dan Wilson going to use him? Is Dan Wilson going to use him as a pure closer? Because Scott Servais did not. And there were times where he was bringing in Munoz in the seventh or eighth inning and then closing with guys like Matt Brash, which, you know, it seems like it doesn't make sense, but it worked for them when they were doing it. So the stuff is elite. The numbers are not what I would call elite. He's got high walk rates historically, you know, 11, 12% in certain seasons that he's been doing it. And I went back and looked a little bit after the All-Star break, and he had seven saves and an ERA of almost 3.5 over the second half of last season. And his ADP right now is about 82. So he's actually about the ninth closer off the board. For me, it's not that I don't like him. I think he's a wonderful talent. I just need, if I'm paying that price, I need 30 saves. I need sparkling ratios. I need a bunch of strikeouts. What I don't need is 50 innings from a guy who might get me 60 strikeouts and, you know, 15 to 20 saves. Now, it's possible he could really pop this year, depending on how Seattle uses him, right? Like, he could obviously expand into that 30-save realm. But at an ADP of 82, I'm not willing to take that risk right now. I'm probably going to try to get a guy like Devin Williams or a Joanne Duran or somebody like that up front, and then wait until later to get a David Bednar, Trevor McGill type of guy later on in drafts if I can wait that long to do it. So it's not that I don't like Munoz. It's just that I'm really unsure of what he's going to really get me. And that makes me a little leery of drafting him.
Did you guys see in that article that we talked about earlier about T-Mobile Park, the home road split from Munoz last year?
Yes.
It's just further proof of maybe he's not as good as we think. Like, his home ERA was 0.28 with a 43% K rate, but his road, he was a 4.28 ERA with a 25% K. So you might be onto something here, because, you know, if you're that good of a pitcher, you should be doing it on the road and at home. And like you said, too, how is he going to be deployed next year? We don't know.
All right. So some questions around Munoz at his current price. Last question that I have for you, Mike, regarding bullpens. Very simple. In your opinion, who do you think is the most undervalued closer in quotation marks, on the board right now?
I think it's actually a tie for me. I think I just mentioned these guys a moment ago. David Bednar is one, and his current ADP is about 189. And Trevor McGill, whose ADP is 194. It's almost like we've forgotten the fact that Bednar was terrific until he was hurt last year. And his lack of production last year was purely because of injury. He tried to pitch through it. He wasn't really able to do that. His numbers really exploded. I don't see Pittsburgh have another option. I don't see Pittsburgh wanting to trade him. He's a local guy. 30 saves to me feels really easy here again. And Trevor McGill, I mean, do we forget? You know, so Devin Williams was there at the end of the year and miraculously blew it against your beloved New York Mets and your beloved Grimace. But here's the thing. This is a guy that had 28 saves last year while they were waiting around for Devin Williams to come back and was lights out in that bullpen. There's no reason why he's not going to be that again. The Brewers are still going to be a pretty good team. I think both of those guys should be going way higher than what they are. To me, there's not a lot of speculation there. Those are both guys that should be able to get in the conversation for 30 saves with health.
Well, I just have to correct you on the ADPs, and this may be format dependent. I'm looking specifically at NFBC draft and hold. So,
oh, gotcha. There you go. Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, it may be different in other formats, other platforms. Bednar is at 143 over the past 11 DCs. And McGill, he's higher. He's at pick 107. So, I don't. So, if at that price, Mike, do you think McGill is, you know, is a good pick there, or do you think you'd be a little more cautious at that
point? That's a little high for me. I think I'd lean more towards Bednar three rounds later.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm with you. I've kind of come around to Bednar. Like you said, they want him to be the closer. Like, they didn't bring in anybody. I mean, unless, you never know. There's still guys out there. But the Pirates are cheap. Like, they're not going to go, I don't think, get a Kenley or you know, and the team is good enough too. It's not like the Pirates are like, they're not the White Sox, right? Like Bednar is going to get save opportunities. They're probably a team that's going to play in a lot of close games, right? Because they have good pitching, don't have a great offense. So, I think Bednar is going to see plenty of opportunities. If he's healthy, I think we're getting probably like, you know, like last year, what was he going? Around six, around five. So I think we're getting a pretty nice discount compared to where he probably should be going or would be going if he was healthy last year.
Yeah, so. But he's not as good as Lucas Erect, though.
He's definitely as good as Lucas Erect.
Like, come on.
Yeah. No, Lucas Erect, I mean, I think he should be closer one off the board, to be absolutely honest.
Better than Carlos Flaccid.
Yes. Yep. All right. Anyway, this is a family show, guys. Come on. You know we've moved to Pitcher List. It's all family and clean, and you know, we have to stick to the book here. But anyway, we're gonna transition away from that and baseball talk, and we're gonna transition to our final segment, our mental health minute. With one little twist, we've been talking ballparks for most of this episode. So as part at the end of your mental health minute, tell us your favorite ballpark and why. So I'm going to start with you, Mike.
So that's a really great question, and it's one that I really gave a lot of thought to. To me, there's always something about going to a Major League Baseball stadium and walking up behind home plate and taking in, you know, the atmosphere once you get up to the top and get into the concourse, right? You know, I've been to I was at Old Yankee Stadium. I've been to the new Yankee Stadium. I've been to Fenway. I've been to a number of games at Wrigley, Sox Park. But my favorite park that I've ever been to of all of those is PNC in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. It was glorious. They shut down the area around the ballpark. You have to walk across a bridge, the Roberto Clemente Bridge, to get into the stadium. The fans are the most knowledgeable, kindest fans that I've ever been around. And they're just wonderful. They're very welcoming to you know, fans of all teams and people that were there. It was just a wonderful place to see a game. I have a group of guys that I travel with. Shout out to Vin and Appleby and John, guys that I travel with every couple of years. And we decided to go to PNC. The Cubs were playing, which was the only drawback to the whole weekend, was that I had to watch the Cubs play. But PNC is a wonderful place, a great sight lines. The food was terrific. The atmosphere was great. I would go back in a heartbeat. If you guys ever get an opportunity to go to PNC, do go. It's really an enjoyable experience.
I want to go out. You know, it's funny. I was thinking the other day, because I hear that from so many people. Like, they love PNC. I've never heard anybody say anything negative about it. I would love to go out. I don't know if it's going to happen this year, but I would love to go see a Paul Skene start over there. Like, I feel like that would just be electric, you know, like just that atmosphere. That'd be super cool. And maybe we, you know, I get a Libby Dunn sighting while I'm there. So,
well, maybe you guys could go with your new podcast co-host.
Yeah. Yes, we may organize a trip and not tell you. all right. What is your, did you want to do a mental health minute or are we moving on?
No, thank you guys for carrying on without me last week. I was so sick. I had the flu last week. It was the sickest I've been in probably 15 years. Just really struggled. So really happy to be back. This is what I needed for my mental health this week. My week has been absolutely insane at work. I've been late getting back to you guys on text messages just because it's been 12-hour days of just crazy. So thank you guys for having me back and allowing me this opportunity tonight to be able to put work aside for an hour and just talk about ball with my buddies.
Awesome. Love having you here. Dave, what about you? Mental health minute and favorite ballpark?
My favorite ballpark, I love tradition and I love history and I love just the length of the game and just how long it's been going on. So for me, it's Lone Depot Park in Miami for, no, I'm just kidding. I was gonna
say, man. And I've been to that park. That park ain't nothing.
No, okay. I haven't actually been to many parks, but I've always wanted to go to Fenway Park. And there's just something about it. It feels like it has its own aura, its own atmosphere, and it feels like every game, just watching it on TV, like every game is its own. I don't know how to explain it. It just feels like it's its own little thing. And I want to take the tour. I want to go backstage. I want to take the tour of the whole place. And I want to sit on the wall itself. I love those seats. I love the idea of the wall. I love that the score gets changed by, you know, manually. And it's just, I don't know. I don't know if you guys have been there. Mike, you said you have, but
I have.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, that'll be on my baseball stadium bucket list.
Awesome. Yeah. I went out and touched the left field foul pole where Carlton Fisk hit the home run in 75 off of the foul pole. I needed to touch that and it was a weird thing. Like left my family aside and I walked over there just kind of mesmerized by it. You know, it's such a great place to see a game.
Yeah, it really is. And like you were saying, Dave, like when you're there, it's like, I've never been to any baseball game where people are as focused on every pitch as they are at Fenway Park. Hmm. I would go up. My buddy had season tickets, so he once in a while I'd go up to see the Yankees play up there. And especially when it's Yankees, Red Sox. And this was like, you know, 15 years ago when the rivalry was still pretty heated. And, you know, it just like the intensity of every pitch, you know, it was just like unreal, man. And like, it was just awesome. Like that was, I remember I went to like a Sunday night game there and A-Rod hit like a grand slam to put the Yankees ahead. It's just like people were devastated. And me, you know, and a couple Yankee fans cheering were like, are we going to get out of here? Okay. it's an amazing, and the area around the ballpark is just so cool. Like, I feel like every ballpark should be in the middle of like, of a city, right? Like Yankee Stadium is like that. Fenway, even Camden Yards has that, like just a walking area. You have the bars, you got the restaurants, like the shops. Like there's something about that. I hate when there are these ballparks that are just in the middle of a highway, right? Like Citi Field. I know their plan is to develop that area, but it's just like, it's very, it just doesn't have a great feel to it, right? You're just in a parking lot and there's nothing around you. But highway, I went to Citizens Bank Park, kind of the same thing, you know, it just, I don't know. I feel like so much of the experience is like before the game, going to different bars, you know, like just seeing like there's such like an atmosphere around it, and you lose that with these parks that are just big pieces of concrete in like the middle of a highway.
You can just walk right up to it just after experiencing the city, and it's part of the city.
It's part of the city, right? There's something. Every new ballpark should be part of the city. Yeah. So, anyway, with you on Fenway Park. That was actually going to be my answer was Fenway, but you mentioned old Yankee Stadium, Mike, and man, I miss it so much. Like I'll watch Yankees classics and see some of these games from, you know, the 90s, early 2000s. And like, I get like, so like it's nostalgic, but I also get kind of sad because, it's, you know, I miss that stadium so much. I grew up in there, you know, so there's that piece of it, but just like it was grimy. It was kind of gross, but it was the Bronx, right? Like it had that feel.
And there's a presence.
It has a presence. And when teams went there, the Yankees had a true home field advantage. Like the fans were right on top of you, you know, like it held sound in a way that the new stadium does not at all. The new stadium just doesn't get that loud. Right. But the way the old stadium was built, and it just like, if you were there and it was a big moment in the game, that place was it gave you goosebumps, you know, like how loud it got. And it just, there's nothing that could replicate that. So, and the other thing you mentioned about going out onto the concourse, like, because now it's all open concourse, so you don't have like, you walk out and you see the field, but with the old stadium, you know, it was all indoors, the concourse, then you walk out the tunnel and you see that field. And I know people have talked about this. It's like, I remember as a kid, it was freaking magic, like to walk through that tunnel and see that field, that
the air changes field. When you get up there. Absolutely different experience.
I'm getting chills thinking about, like, just as a kid, like just that image, how much I love baseball. And then just like going to the stadium when I was little, it was like it was almost like a religious experience. Mm-hmm. I'm getting a little carried away, but it's, you know, it really meant so much, you know, and like it just, the new park, it's nice, it's fine, but it just doesn't have that same feel that the old one does. So it's gone. What are you gonna do? You move on. But yeah, in terms of new stadiums in New York, Citi Field's much, even though I don't like the area around it, the park itself, I think, is much better than Yankee Stadium. But that's a discussion for another day. We are going to leave it there for today. We will be back next week with another episode. I hope for those of you who are starting to get into drafts and get into your prep, hope that is going well. You can always feel free to reach out to us if you have questions. Follow us on Twitter at Fantasy, the letter B, beat. We'll definitely help you out where we can. But we'll leave it there for today. For Mike Carter, for Dave Funnel, I'm Chris Torres. Thank you so much for listening to Fantasy Baseball Beat. All right, fellas.